What are the secrets about ourselves that nature can teach us?
If you get deep enough into the wilderness, you can hear what nature is saying. Yeah, my mother was right. We need to get out, way out yonder where the crawdads sing, because that is where our secrets lie.
Our secrets?
Our secrets. That is where we can learn about ourselves. If we get far enough into the wilderness, we can actually learn about ourselves.
That's Delia Owens. Her breakout novel, Where the Crawdads Sing, explores isolation, connection, and the healing power of nature. Then another novel, this time about nature gone awry. We replay our 2012 interview with Barbara Kingsolver about her book, Flight Behavior. And finally, I share a story with you about a man who hunted plants in the wilds of southern France. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. In Delia Owens' novel, Where the Crawdads Sing, a young woman lives a hermit's life in the salt marshes of North Carolina. She craves connection, but the abuse and abandonment she suffered as a child keeps her away from most human contact. It doesn't help that she's reviled and feared as the marsh girl by the residents of a nearby town. So instead, she turns to the denizens of the natural world around her for her friends, until, that is, a murder in the marsh casts suspicion on her. A breakout sensation that is number one on Indie Bounds and the Washington Post bestsellers list, Where the Crawdads Sing is at once a coming-of-age novel, a mystery thriller, and a lyric exploration of our connection to nature. Delia Owens is a wildlife scientist who studied social groups among animals like lions and elephants. She's also the co-author of several nonfiction books about her life as a wildlife scientist in Africa. Where the Crawdads Sing is her debut novel. Delia Owens, thanks so much for coming on to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me, Francesca. This is just great.
So, Where the Crawdads Sing, this is your first novel, your first work of fiction, in fact. You're a wildlife scientist. You studied wildlife in Africa for more than two decades, and you wrote three books out of that experience. Just curious, what drew you to creating a fictional story that takes place in a marsh on the North Carolina coast?
Oh, well, I wanted so badly to write fiction, and to me, nonfiction's a little bit restraining, you know. It's like riding a horse behind a corral, because you have to have all the facts correct, the dates and the places, everything has to line up. And with writing fiction, you're just free to go wherever you want. It's like riding your horse out across the meadow and up into the mountain. And by the time I had studied wildlife for so many years in Africa, I had so many things had built up in me that I wanted to express. I wanted so badly to show people how isolation affects people. I had learned so much about studying social mammals that I felt like I understood some of our behavior, and I just wanted to get that on paper. I wanted to share it with other people, and I thought fiction was just the way to do it.
Well, yeah, and you did an amazing job here in this book. And before we get into the book itself, just tell us a little bit about what social animals you studied.
I studied lions in the Kalahari Desert and brown hyenas in the Kalahari Desert. And then I studied elephants in the Luangwa Valley. The one thing that impacted me the most about studying those species is that I knew it, of course, it was already known, but it really made an impression on me that those mammals that live in socially bonded groups, like the pride of lions and the troop of baboons and the herd of elephants, the groups are made up of females. They're not both sexes. They're females only, and they stay in these groups for all of their lives. And I was living in a very isolated situation. I didn't have a chance to have a group of females. And it really demonstrated to me how important those groups are, and that's one reason I wanted to write this book.
And why this setting? Why the North Carolina coast, marsh there?
I chose the North Carolina coast for several reasons, poetic reasons and practical reasons. The story Where the Crawdads Sing is a story about a young girl, Kaya, who was abandoned at a young age, and she survives on her own. I wanted that to be realistic. I didn't want it to be fanciful. It's a situation which could really have happened. And the marsh in North Carolina has a temperate climate. She didn't have to worry about being cold. She had a shack. She knew by the time she was abandoned, she could fish. And in that marsh, you can literally walk around and collect mussels and oysters, so you really can feed yourself. So it was a practical reason that she really could have survived there. And also for poetic reasons, I chose the marsh, because in this book, the marsh is a character almost. It's a very strongly developed character. And the marsh is a beautiful place of light with these waterways, these sparkling waterways that stream through the areas of tall grass. And yet in some places, there are true swamps that are dark and quiet. And I found that in life, it seems that all of us at one time or the other end up in the swamp instead of the bright marsh. And that's what this book is about, is how we can move in those dark times, how we can move from the darkness back into the light.
Yes, and certainly with her, with Kaya, as you say, she is abandoned at a young age, 6. When we first meet her, she's just been abandoned by her mother, who's fleeing her abusive drunkard father. So by the time she's 11, she's really on her own. How does she survive in this marsh? I mean, you say she can gather. She doesn't really hunt. You don't even have a protagonist who particularly wants to fish. So tell us about her and her character and, you know, her personality and how she survives.
Well, I say Kaya. I pronounce it Kaya. But she took off on her own. As soon as I put Kaya on paper, really her character grew. And I was surprised at some of the characteristics that she had. She was abandoned, but she was able and capable. She was tough because she'd been raised in the marsh, and she did know how to fish. She did know how to collect mussels. But she was tenacious, and to me, she shows all of us that we can do more than we think we can. That was part of her purpose in the book, was to show us how much we can do when we have to. But I just loved her personality because she became, you know, witty and gritty, and she was somebody you would like to know, I think.
But also somebody who has a real fear, you know, who is not only isolated, but in some ways chooses her isolation, chooses not to go to school. She's one day in school where she's set upon by the other children. The adults seem to be in a community that is quite near her home, seem to see her as isolated. Nobody takes, until a certain point, nobody really takes care of her. Did that seem to be something that could actually happen in the 1950s?
Yes, that's another important part of the story. It's really just discrimination and rejection. She was different. She had no troop. She had no group. She was isolated. They had a very strong sense of community in their little village, but it happens all the time. They considered, you know, she wore ratty clothes. She wasn't part of their group, so they discriminated against her. And it happens a lot. They called her names. They didn't help her. They thought she was dirty. They thought she would bring diseases into the town. They didn't want their children to associate with her. And the children laughed at her. They bullied her. This is part of everyday life. You don't have to live in a swamp. You don't have to wear ratty clothes to be rejected and discriminated against. it happens so often in society, and that is a bad part of who we are, but I think that was another point in our book of what we can learn from looking at other species, is how this sort of behavior of rejection and discrimination evolves and how to deal with it, but also learning how it affects a person. I think one of the important questions of the book is when one character, I won't say who, comes out and says, did the villagers discriminate against Kaya because she was different, or was she different because they discriminated against her?
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, certainly there must be a give and take with those two things. And you know, you studied baboons and these other social animals, as you say. I mean, what is the purpose of rejection? And I say this as someone who experienced a fair amount of rejection from my peers when I was a kid, because I also was different. My parents were, you know, kind of bohemians in suburban New Jersey, which made me... which made me quite the pariah with other kids.
Oh, I know. And look at the bullying that goes on. Yes, it's actually, unfortunately, very, very common. But it's common in nature because, for example, take baboons. The troops have to defend their resources. Resources can be abundant in Africa in some parts, but in a lot of places they're very sparse, and they're going around maybe 30 in a group, females, and they're young. They have to find the trees that are bearing fruit at the moment, or grass seeds. And if they look up and there's this scraggly creature, another baboon, that starts approaching them that's not part of their troop, they are going to chase it away. They're not going to share their resources with an outsider, because they are protecting those resources for their own offspring. And so there's discrimination right there. Chase that guy off because in this case probably a female, chase strangers away. They're going to take our resources. And we have that genetic material we have within us, and we know better today. We're humans. We know we should share. We know we should accept people who are different. But if we look back to why we behaved that way, we can understand it was for survival reasons at one time, and it doesn't make it right, but it helps us understand.
I'm Francesca Rhiannon, and this is Writer's Voice. We're talking with Delia Owens about her number one best-selling debut novel, Where the Crawdads Sing. It's about a young woman who grows up alone after being abandoned as a child in a salt marsh in North Carolina in the 1950s. Yeah, and you just mentioned it, you know, is she discriminated against because she's different, or is she different because she's discriminated against? That's kind of the nature versus nurture idea. Do you see nature versus nurture, or do you see it as more of an interplay?
Well, the question of nature versus nurture started by asking, it wasn't a question of whether they were playing against each other. It was about whether any particular behavior that we exhibit, did we inherit it? And they coined that as being nature. If we inherited it, if it's genetic, then it's nature. If we learned it while we were growing up, it was nurture. And that was a very, very interesting discussion that we had. I don't know when it was, the 1970s, 1980s. But to me, we have to go deeper than that. It's not just a question of whether behavior that we exhibit is inherited or learned, but why? If it's genetic material, why? If a female abandons an offspring, why do we have this in our genes? If you look back in nature, you can see that in the wild, sometimes it's necessary to abandon current offspring, say in a very, very bad drought, and the mother is going to die if she tries to raise these cubs, so she abandons them. Then when the rains come and conditions are better, then she can raise a new litter, and they live to survive. I mean, they hang on long enough to survive. So you see what I'm saying? Those behaviors that seem so bad sometimes have a survival history. And that's the reason sometimes we have these genes within us. And just understanding that, I think, helps us understand ourselves better.
Yeah, I mean, of course, we like to think of ourselves as so much more intelligent than all the other animals. you know, so we point to culture as a way of improving, you know, kind of not being the prisoners of our genes. And in this book, Delia Owens, in this novel, Where the Crawdads Sing, you have Kaya think about why did her mother abandon her? And you link it to the example that you just gave, that sometimes there's the survival of the species that takes precedence. But in this case, it's really not it. So again, what were you reaching for in this concept, this idea about why she's abandoned by her mother?
Well, the reason on the surface is because her mother, just like, and I used in the book, I used the example of foxes. The foxes, this particular fox female had been badly injured and could not survive and take care of her young. And so she was under stress. The female fox was under stress. Kaya's mother, Ma, in the book, was under a huge amount of stress because of her horrible husband who beat her and all of that. So she was under stress, just like the female fox. So it wasn't right of her to leave her children, but she was almost out of her mind. She had become mentally unstable. And so that is the reason that she left. And again, it doesn't make it right. It's just it helps us understand when people do things like that to say, okay, yeah, she was under a lot of stress, but also she had the genes in her to do that behavior. And right. Culture, as you mentioned, is very important. Culture, our society and our mores and our values that we have help us overcome these things. There are a lot of people who feel stress and doesn't give them an excuse to leave their children. But in extreme cases, it happens, and in extreme cases, it can help us understand why it can happen.
Right. Now, Kaya also, you know, she's not just left out there in the marsh struggling to survive. At a certain point, as a child, she's taught to read by a friend of hers, and she actually becomes a naturalist, an artist, and a successful author. A little bit of a fantasy I could certainly relate to. And so how did you reconcile the unsocialized parts of Kaya with the advanced position that she actually achieves in the world?
Well, I think you can. I mean, obviously, a lot of people do. And I think that was part of the point that, yes, we want to belong to groups. We have a strong genetic propensity to belong to groups, but we can't always do it. A lot of people are isolated. I came back from Africa to find that most of my friends who lived in large cities felt isolated and alone, and they're still achievers. We do have the ability to achieve success in situations that are not socially acceptable, and a lot of us do it. I'd say most of us do it, and that's part of what Kaya is about, is that there's some of Kaya in all of us. We can all do much more than we think, and even when conditions aren't right, we can do a lot more than we think we can.
And that's an inspiring part of that story. Now, the title, Where the Crawdads Sing, tell us a little bit about that title.
When I was growing up in South Georgia, I was very, very lucky to have this wonderful mother, and she would encourage me to go way out into the woods. We lived in the middle of the woods in South Georgia, and she would encourage me to go way out. She wanted me to experience nature. She was a real outdoor girl herself, and she wanted me to go out and watch the deer and the little foxes doing what they really do, which you can see as well. She never really dreamed how seriously I would take her advice, but she would say to me, "Go way out yonder where the crawdads sing." It was an expression that she used. And so I used it all my life when we talk about going way out. I'd say, "Yeah, we need to go way out there where the crawdads sing." Of course, crawdads don't really sing. But that's another point of the story, really, is that if you get deep enough into the wilderness, you can hear what nature is saying. Yeah, my mother was right. We need to get out, way out yonder, where the crawdads sing, because that is where our secrets lie.
Our secrets?
Our secrets. That is where we can learn about ourselves. If we get far enough into the wilderness, we can actually learn about ourselves.
And our connection to everything else.
And our connections.
Yeah, you know, this book is clearly written with a profound lyric sense. You talked about the poetry before, a profound love of nature, biophilia, as we call it, a real fundamental human need. How do we, and I guess how do you, and then by extension we, reconcile our love for nature, our need for nature, with, I guess, what is becoming so much grief now of those of us who are aware of this at what we are doing to nature?
I'm not sure we can. It's very, very sad, and I never give up hope. We're losing many species, and it's a sad day for conservation. But we do have a lot of people who care, and I look at it this way: nature always wins, and we may lose a lot of it, which is sad, but we will lose as well. And who knows who will win in the end, but it's usually nature.
Right.
We need to listen to that, and we need to try to do what we can to protect it, because every single thing we need on Earth, everything we use, comes from nature, the things that we really need to survive. But I just want to hasten to say that I worked in conservation for years, and that's what my other three nonfiction books were about. But in this book, the messaging is not heavy-handed. It's not a strong. I never talk about conservation in the book. It comes through through the story, but it's not. I don't get into the depressing aspects of conservation. I just let the marsh speak for itself and how important it is.
And you do so, so eloquently. Delia Owens, your novel is Where the Crawdads Sing, and I want to thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Delia Owens. Read an excerpt from Where the Crawdads Sing by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, Barbara Kingsolver's novel about climate change. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Back in 2012, we spoke with celebrated fiction writer Barbara Kingsolver about her novel Flight Behavior. It's about what happens when a rural community in Tennessee is confronted with a bizarre phenomenon caused by global warming. Let's listen to that conversation. Until recently, the greatest story of all time, human-caused climate change and the threat it poses to our survival, was largely ignored by major fiction writers. There was Margaret Atwood, of course, and on this show, we interviewed Paolo Bacigalupi about his dystopian science fiction novel for young adults, Shipbreaker. But the field has been thin. Now, acclaimed author Barbara Kingsolver has come out with her novel Flight Behavior. It takes up the theme of climate change and tackles some thorny issues about class along the way. Kingsolver grew up in rural Kentucky. The people of Flight Behavior are her people. Her protagonist, Delarobia Turnbow, struggles to come to terms with the reality of a changing world while navigating the boundaries between her poor rural community and a group of scientists who suddenly drop into it. They teach her something about science, and she teaches them something about communicating with ordinary people. Both are needed if we're to deal with the grave environmental challenges before us. Barbara Kingsolver, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
The action in this novel, Flight Behavior, begins with your protagonist, Delarobia, love that name, climbing up the mountain behind her Tennessee home. What is she doing, and what does she find?
This all happens really quickly. This is a novel that that kind of explodes out of the gate. As you meet this young woman, you learn a lot of things about her quickly. She's been married for more than 10 years, and she's in her 20s. She got pregnant in high school, and she's been kind of stuck in this really pretty miserable life on a failing farm, and she is sneaking out to meet a man who's not her husband, and she's never done this before, and her heart is racing, and she's in the context of a very religious family, and she's, you know, been trying a long time to do the right thing, and yet she's just kind of reached the end of her rope on a very stultifying life, just kind of trapped in this life with small children and never leaving the house. So she's going up the mountain to an assignation, we could say, a tryst, and she never gets there. Instead, she comes upon an entirely unexpected sight of what looks to her like a forest in flames. She reaches this kind of little lookout point on the trail as she's going up the mountain, and she looks out, and the whole valley is just kind of trembling orange like fire, but it's not fire. She knows that there's no rational explanation for it. She thinks it's a miracle or something like a burning bush, and all she can think to do is turn around, march home, pick up her kids from her mother-in-law, and try to get her life straightened out. However, that does not happen.
In fact, what has happened? What has she seen? It takes her a while to even find out what it is.
That's right. And it takes everybody a while because it's a very strange sight. It's something that's never happened before. And I am determined not to give this away. I know plenty of other people will, and you know, and maybe you will, but it's my job not to spoil anything. So my wish is that the reader, so you'll notice I didn't put it on the book jacket or anything. I wanted the readers to see this sight and share Delarobia's amazement of not knowing what it is. But I will tell you, it's not a miracle. It is ascertained to be, I guess you'd just say, a bizarre, freak biological event. It can be explained biologically. It's an aggregation of something on this mountainside that really shouldn't be there. And so it causes great consternation. Immediately, the media are there, and scientists are there trying to understand why this has happened, and they quickly figure out it's because of abrupt changes in the climate that have disrupted the migratory pattern of a particular living thing that has come to aggregate on this mountainside.
And an incredibly fragile thing as well. I found it a really powerful metaphor for all the fragile species, including ours, that are threatened by climate change.
Right. And it was interesting to research this because it's not science fiction, but it's fiction that's grounded in science. So I wanted everything about, even though I'm describing an event that has not happened, I wanted to make sure that it was realistically based on good science. So I sought out the expertise of some scientists who have spent their lives doing research on migratory insects and birds and other animals. I'm giving every kind of hint, aren't I? But just to make sure that this was plausible, even though it hasn't happened, and how, and if it did happen, why would it happen? So there's a lot of science in the book, and that was a really fun challenge for me because I was trained as a scientist.
Well, I was going to say, so you were trained as a scientist. This book has a lot of things that are packed into it. It's a many-layered book. I want to say to our listeners also that it is just a terrifically written novel. It has very compelling and complex characters in it. It's the first novel I've read that tackles two big issues and intertwines them, and that's climate change and class.
Mm-hmm. Environmentalism and class. That's really what I wanted to write about.
Right. So say more about that.
Well, I'm very interested because I live in southern Appalachia, and I am an environmentalist, and I live among farmers and rural people, and I see clearly in my daily life how the environmental movement in the United States is kind of missing the boat in terms of talking with rural working class people. Just in general, the culture wars are getting worse instead of better. And I think that it's awfully important not to condescend, or to put this another way, it's impossible to have a legitimate conversation with another person unless you really respect that person and you believe that person has a valid life, legitimate ideas, and very good reasons to believe what they believe. It's a problem that's really frustrating to me because I am of Southern Appalachia. I grew up here. These are my people. I wanted to represent us to the world both honestly and nobly.
You know, I used to live in southeastern West Virginia, in Monroe County.
Oh, I know right where that is.
And I know whereof you speak. And one of the things that I loved about this book, Barbara Kingsolver, about flight behavior, is the wonderful way that you portray the people of that region with respect. And so much so that you have your main character, Della Robbia, being able to stand up to a scientist, someone she greatly admires, someone who's become a friend, and tell him exactly where those scientists are missing the boat. And I have it right here on page 321. She has the analysis. She basically says that it's really kind of about an identity politics. She says people sort themselves out. Like kids in a family, they have to stake out their different territories, teacher's pet or the rascal. Explain that statement. What is she trying to tell Ovid Byron, Dr. Ovid Byron?
She's trying to explain to him that nothing is as simple as it looks from his ivory tower. Really what got me into this novel was my thinking about how people decide what to believe. I think that all of us go around pretending that we are utterly rational beings who weigh the evidence and reach our conclusions based on the evidence, and we are therefore right, and anyone who doesn't agree with us is wrong. I don't think that's how it works. I think that we're much more intuitive than we'd like to think. I think most of us kind of start with what we believe in, and then we gather evidence to prove that we're right. So, and I think, you know, it's not one side that does this, it's both sides, it's every side. It's how the human animal works. I think we believe information that's given to us from sources we trust. And trust doesn't really have to do with college degrees. We place our faith in people that we think are going to look out for our clan. It's very tribal or sort of clannish. I think people are social animals and we stick to our group. It's insider status that makes someone trustworthy. So we listen to the radio news commentators or tune into the TV stations that we think are trustworthy because they're going to tell us what we already believe, right? I mean, everybody does this. So the point then is that this Dr. Ovid Byron, who is a rational man as a scientist, is just baffled. He's saying, why don't you people, you know, believe in climate change? It's staring you, you know, down. It's wrecking your crops already, and this is the truth. It is. And she's saying, why would we believe you? You know, you're an outsider. What have you done for us? We are Team Camo. You know, we are looking out for each other. We are taking care of each other. You're an outsider here. I think that's a really important element of the conversation that's being overlooked.
And how does one overcome it? Because interestingly enough, I mean, it's probably been a whole lot of outsiders, very wealthy outsiders, who have manipulated the conversations in the media that people listen to. You know, it's the Koch brothers of the world, who couldn't be further from Della Robbia's life.
That's right.
Who are
Little
the ones?
Does she know the people who have really manipulated information, and yet. There's more to this than information. And, you know, you asked, what do we do about that? Or, how do we cross this divide? Obviously, it's not a simple answer. And there's not one answer. And I wrote a whole novel just kind of asking that question. But I think it has to do with trust. People will believe a source only if they trust it. And if that source begins the conversation by saying, well, you're stupid and I'm going to enlighten you, then that's the end of the conversation right there.
That's true. But there is a wonderful scene in this book where Dr. Byron, you know, does get to kind of let loose out of his own, inner gut.
The rational man finally blows his stack with a reporter. And boy, was that scene fun to write.
It was fun to read, too. So say what are you talking about in terms of the media here? And we have to say also, I mean, it's kind of the new media that spreads it around the world.
That does what around the world?
It spreads it around the world.
Right. This novel is also about globalization in many ways, and how no one is an island. You know, there is no such thing as isolation anymore. Even this young woman who has hardly been out of her county and has not slept outside of her house, you know, in 11 years of marriage, does something that gets her put on the internet and she becomes an overnight celebrity globally. And of course, that's not a great thing. It wrecks her life in 100 different ways. But I think I wanted to kind of tug at people's preconceived ideas about worldliness. This character, Della Robbia, is just about the least worldly person you could imagine. I mean, as I said, she's not traveled. But we don't live with the same boundaries that we used to. Everybody has access to everything all the time, and it's a different world. And the lines that we draw between urban and rural, between, you know, worldly and naive, they're all messed up. They're not what we think they are, and that really sort of wreaks havoc with Della Robbia's life. But it's also meant to incite the reader to think about how nothing really happens in isolation, and climate change above all. I mean, the climate knows no boundaries, and regions no longer have the right to act in isolation. Countries no longer have the right to act in isolation, make isolated decisions about things that can affect the whole globe at once.
And also individuals can affect the whole globe,
right,
for ill or for good.
Right.
And we're talking with Barbara Kingsolver about her acclaimed new novel, Flight Behavior. It's about what happens when climate change comes to a small rural community in Tennessee.
You know, I loved your portrayal of Della Robbia's two young children.
Thank you.
I am still a mother, but my son is grown now. But the deftness of the portrayal and of the details, I loved her older son who is, he's 5 and a half, a very precocious kid who is very interested in science. But I also really loved the little one, the toddler, her daughter. You just have such wonderful ways of describing these children that just warm a mother's heart.
Well, thank you, and also perhaps make her want to run screaming from the room, right? It's interesting to me that children are almost non-existent in literature, especially modern literature. Nobody's writing about kids, and I spent years wondering why that is, and then I figured it out. Oh, people with kids aren't writing literature. They're raising their kids. It's not an easy thing to do both at once. But it's all I've ever done. I signed my first book contract literally the same week I had my first child. So I've always been a mother and a writer. And my kids, the experience of having children and raising children has obviously hugely informed my writing. And I also really love kids as characters. Not as caricatures or furniture, which is how they're usually used in books and movie and movies and TV, but as real characters, because they're not less smart than adults. They're just less experienced. But it's a fascinating kind of lens to use, and I really love these characters of Preston and Cordelia. And also motherhood. I think perhaps another reason people might shy away from using kids, small children as characters in fiction, is that there is, I suppose, a risk of sentimentality. But I'm a pretty unsentimental mother. I mean, I was ready to be very clear about the fact that Della Robbia is, she loves her children fiercely, and she also would be the first to tell you that they're driving her crazy. She says to her friend Dovey, "What would I know? I spend my time with people who eat thumbtacks off the floor." It's taking care of small children consumes a life in a way that's very difficult to describe to someone who hasn't done it, and that's not really a bed of roses.
Right, and I'd have to say there's absolutely nothing sentimental about your descriptions of Cordelia playing with her food in the high chair, but it's one that just had me laughing out loud.
But banging on it like a heavy metal drummer.
Exactly.
Yeah, I also really loved Cordelia. I loved making this portrait of this wild child. She's sort of Della Robbia. Della Robbia has this wild streak. She was a wild girl in high school. She ran sort of with the fast crowd in it, and it backfired on her, and then she became anchored as a wife and mother. But she sees that wild streak kind of bubbling up in her daughter, and she both admires and dreads it for what it may mean for her daughter. So that was a thread of character that I really enjoyed. And of course, as a mother, there all of the, not that either of my children is anything like these two children, but as I say, the experience of motherhood informs everything that I do. And I know as a mother myself how loaded that experience is when you see something of yourself in your kid and you think, oh man, you think two things at once. You think, well, she's really mine, and I probably deserve this, whatever's coming out of it.
And then on a more serious note also, I felt that this book was written very much from the point of view of a mother, at least that's how I felt reading it myself. When we talk about climate change.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember it was about 3 or 4 years ago. I have a granddaughter who's 8. I remember the moment that I realized that we are experiencing the end of the world as we and hundreds of thousands of years of human beings have known it.
Yep.
I mean, the death of so many species that our children will never get to see, the end of a way of life that's been around for eons. And
even the end of agriculture as we know it. I mean, there will be agriculture, but it will be nothing like what we've been used to. You're exactly right. That's the very serious heart of this novel. I had to tell this story from the point of view of a fairly young person who is deeply invested in the future. I mean, Della Robbia really feels like she hasn't gotten to have her life yet, and her kids really haven't gotten to have their lives yet. And before all this happened, she thought the worst thing, you know, the hardest thing she had to worry about on her kids' behalf was trying to, you know, keep them fed and intact and maybe saving up for them to go to college. So when she understands that they're looking down the maw of a drastically altered and reduced world, this is so hard for her to take. It makes her angry at Ovid Byron. It's sort of, you know, sort of shooting the messenger. She kind of wishes he would just go away. She wishes she didn't know all this stuff that he's telling her. And you as a reader, I hope, will relate to the resistance that people have to this. There are many reasons to resist understanding and believing in climate change, and a really big one is if you feel like you haven't gotten your fair shake yet, your fair share yet, and the people who had the most are kind of robbing it from your kids, that's a really, really hard thing to hear.
It is. It's something I struggle with every day, all day. And
yeah.
I want to ask you, I mean, I remember the shock and grief that I had when I realized this. The shock's gone away, but the grief is still there. Could you talk about how you wrestle with this?
I write novels. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is what I do when and the content of all of my books derives from, I guess, a combination of grief and hope. The things that worry me the most, the things that I most want people to be talking about and thinking about and asking themselves and answering for themselves, those are the things that I have to write about. I'm not interested in small matters as a novelist. I'm interested in grave matters.
Well, Barbara Kingsolver, this terrific latest novel of yours, Flight Behavior, I just want to thank you so much for talking with us here.
You're very welcome. Thanks a lot.
That was my 2012 interview with Barbara Kingsolver. Longtime listeners to Writer's Voice may remember that I've been working on a memoir about an 8-month sojourn in Provence that I made in 2001 to 2002. Well, the book is finally finished, and it's titled Province of the Heart. I've read a few stories from it over the years, and here's one more. The story of a man who found his work and his joy hunting healing plants in the wilds of southern France. The Cure Hunter. There's only one Provence in the world, Fabien declared. It was just a few weeks after 9/11, not long after I arrived from New York's JFK Airport for a long-planned stay in the rugged hills of Haute-Provence. I was still trying to adjust to my new notion of the world post-terror attacks. A neighbor of my host, Fabienne, had invited me for coffee and a view from her terrace, a welcome distraction from the fear and foreboding tangling my thoughts. I knew what Fabienne was referring to, not the uniqueness of the landscape, but the singular congruity of Provence's inhabitants with it. Their life seemed to go on as it had all along, not just over decades, but over centuries. The immemorial heart of the village beat unchanged. As always, farmer, artisan, shopkeeper, and neighbor traced their intersecting trajectories within the visible circumference of their world, ringed by the sheltering hills. The global winds of anarchy did not seem to blow here, only the famed Mistral. Over the days following my arrival and then the ensuing months, the region's dreamlike terrain came to inhabit me, shaping the interior landscape of my heart to its contours. It was a living canvas painted with iconic images, villages clinging like doves to the steeples of their hills, sheep and shepherd stitching their way across the lavender-striped quilt of the land. Haute-Provence was like a fantasy, a hallucinatory, arid Eden, whose vividness, paradoxically, summoned me into the real moment. It was therapy to my soul. My habitual internal narratives about past and future had been intensified by 9/11 and its aftermath, burning buildings and falling people, followed by falling bombs and burning people. But the limestone hills and azure sky commanded my gaze, short-circuiting my solipsistic trance. Brilliant blue butterflies sketched patterns on the air. Wildflowers splashed their pointillistic colors against the tawny fields. The clang of sheep bells, a songbird's arpeggio, or the persistent hooting of the cuckoo, sounding from sunup to sundown, were periodic calls to attention that jolted me out of my self-hypnosis. I was drawn quickly into an embracing circle of new friends, their hospitality unstinting. They took great pleasure in sharing the abundant gifts of their land, black, fragrant truffles, soft discs of goat cheese wrapped in native chestnut leaves, wine tapped from great gleaming barrels down at the local winery into bottles brought from home, the view from a terrace or a hike in the hills, all leavened with the yeast of good conversation. Raw and bruised after 9/11, and beset with the fearful realization that the world crisis made me and all I loved personally vulnerable, I found a measure of restoration in this remote and beautiful region, where the connections between people and between people and their environment are always vivid and palpable. The world began making sense again. No one embodied this spirit of connection more than one Monsieur Cavan, the cure hunter. A week after my arrival, I took my host's car to the market town of Fauconquier. A metropolis compared to the tiny villages that surround it, Fauconquier's market is a cornucopia of delights. Under broad canvas tents, merchants waited on browsers and buyers like hospitable sheikhs. I wandered overwhelmed past all the bounty, jostling shoulders with the polyglot crush of residents and tourists that crowded the narrow streets. I was looking for an herbal tea that could cure my troubled sleep. During the day, the charms of my new surroundings distracted me, but at night I wrestled with horror about what I had left behind in New York and anxiety about the future. I tossed and turned on my narrow bed, rocked by a stormy sea of dread. Provence is a botanical garden of medicinal herbs, of which lavender is the best known. The dry Mediterranean climate forces plants to conserve moisture with tough, oily leaves. Strolling among the booths, I chanced upon just the thing, a table laid out with an array of cellophane packages of dried herbs neatly stacked in rows. Monsieur Catuzian Cavan, ramasseur des simples, said the sign on the vendor's van. I browsed silently for several minutes, searching for something familiar among the offerings. But the French names confused me, and I hovered in indecision. A short, stocky man with a rumpled look moved around the interior of the van. I was the only customer, and he peered out at me finally with an air of friendly invitation. "Is there something I can help you with?" he asked. Perhaps in deference to my foreignness, his French was slow and distinct. I told him my problem, and he pointed to a bag containing elongated leaves and wisps of small flowers. "Many people use linden to help them sleep," he offered as he handed it to me. "Is it organic?" I asked. "Ah," he exclaimed with delight, as if this were the very question he'd been waiting for. "See?" And he pointed to a sign, "Ramasseur des simples." "That means I gather all the herbs from the wild," he proclaimed with pride. "All the other herbs sold here are grown by farmers, often with chemicals." He wrinkled his nose in disapproval. "Where do your herbs come from?" "All over. Take this one, for example. Do you know what it is?" "Bear's garlic," I translated the label silently. I shook my head no. "I take that from the Massif Central, the Great Plateau. Sometimes I travel hundreds of kilometers to find a single bush, and I can spend days in the hunt." "It must cost a lot in fuel and labor if you're traveling so far. How do you make any money?" I queried him. He looked at me for a moment as a slow smile lit his grizzled face. "I don't make very much, but I don't need much either. What do I need a lot of money for? I have a home, enough food to eat. If I charged according to the labor, nobody would buy my herbs." His prices were indeed reasonable, less than $3 for a good-sized bag. I thought of the pleasures of spending one's days hiking the hills and valleys of wild Provence. "And your work must be quite enjoyable, too, no?" "Voilà," he agreed, then confided. "I am a chasseur, really. Others hunt animals. I hunt plants. It's a kind of sport for me. It is le geste de curé, cure hunting." "Are they all that difficult to find? Don't you know where to find the plants from one year to the next?" "Not at all. One year the plant is here, another year it's somewhere else. Some years there are many, others none at all. Nature is like that." And he grinned broadly, evidently undisturbed by the vagaries of supply. Monsieur Catuzian is a happy man. He loves his work, his needs are few, and the sun-drenched hills of southern France are his workshop and study. That evening I steeped some dried linden leaves and imbibed a steaming brew. Then I slept like a baby. And that was my story, The Cure Hunter, from my memoir, Province of the Heart. That was my story, The Cure Hunter, excerpted from my memoir of Provence, Province of the Heart. I finally finished it, and I'm looking for an agent who can help to get it published. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox, or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.